by this decision by the Prime Minister to go forward with this after we had given a consolidated a testimony.
Well, clearly another issue we have to cover, but we have to wrap up now. Michael Vendiola, thank you for joining us. And Clark Williams-Derry will link to your report, The Rickety Finances Behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. That does it for our show. Tonight, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary here in New York City at Riverside Church. Tune in at 7 p.m. for our special live stream of Democracy Now!'s celebration with Harry Belafonte, Noam Chomsky, Patti Smith, Danny DeVito, Danny Glover, Tom Morello, Juan Gonzalez, Patti Smith, and others. You can watch right here at democracynow.org or on your station. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Collisions are induced from the conformist-infused practice. They want me to change me, but don't change me. How do you be yourself and change yourself? Because those intuitive illusions got me confusing, losing myself as a positive conclusion. Because holding on to who you are, to me, is what matters when this ends.
Hear the Oregon State Penitentiary Uhuru Sasa Poetry Share on Prison Pipeline, Monday, December 5th at 6:30 p.m.
This isn't black or white, chromosome X or Y, heterosexual or bi. It's a question of why we always section the pie. And the thesis is that we'll never see peace until we see that each piece is cut from the same matter, and that's really what matters.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Able Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building in Portland. The Oregon Able Savings Plan will allow people with disabilities and their families save for the future without losing their state and federal benefits. The disability community has worked for 10 years to pass Able legislation and are holding this event to celebrate and educate others about the opportunity. There will be refreshments, activities for kids, information, and more. Again, that's Oregon Able Savings Plan launch on December 6th at 5 p.m. at the White Stag Building. That's at 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Army Corps of Engineers last night announced that it will not grant an easement needed for construction of the Dakota Pipeline.
The trial of a police officer in South Carolina for the murder of Jacob Scott ended today in a mistrial.
And this Thursday, the Portland City Council is to consider a proposal that would require developers to offer affordable housing units in all new projects with more than 20 residences.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News from Monday, December 5th, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Ken Jones. The Direct Action Alliance held a protest yesterday against the Dakota Pipeline in solidarity with the water protectors at Standing Rock. The protest turned into a prayerful gathering to acknowledge the news that the Army Corps of Engineers decided to not grant an easement for construction of the pipeline. For more on this story, KBOO reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Jacob Barreras with the Direct Action Alliance.
So my name is Jacob Barreras, and I'm a member of Direct Action Alliance, and we're a local organization that aims to ally with other direct action networks and kind of boost those networks and confront Trump wherever he's encroaching.
And Jacob, you, the Direct Action Alliance had an action last night regarding Standing Rock. Could you tell us about it?
Yes. So the action last night was organized in response to the initial eviction notice that was issued by the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as the evacuation order that subsequently came out from the governor's office. Of course, because of the news that we received yesterday afternoon that the Army Corps of Engineers had decided to be on the right side of history in this particular issue, they were no longer a target for the protesters to go out and peacefully assemble in front of. So what we ended up doing last night was meeting up for a prayerful gathering to recognize the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers had acknowledged what was going on and have denied the final easement. So our protest today, which was in solidarity with Standing Rock and the concern about the eviction that might come, was basically transformed now. And what we are doing now is going and rallying to acknowledge the Army Corps of Engineers, acknowledge the city of Portland, the fact that City Council passed a resolution in support of Standing Rock. We want to acknowledge the local politicians like Merkley and Wyden, who issued a letter to Obama, and all the local activists who have created a huge network of support in the local area. And we want to assemble and acknowledge that. And from here on out, we are going to focus on the others who are still supporting DAPL. I mean, we got a statement last night from Energy Transfer Partners stating that they still intend to construct the pipeline. So right now what we are doing is assembling to acknowledge the progress we've made and to acknowledge the fact that this fight is not yet done. We will be looking at good places here in Portland who have assets down there, like U.S. Bank Corp, for example. We also have Phillips 66, who have a terminal in Northwest Portland. So there are many sites where we can bring this direct action, and we want to let everybody know what we intend to do and that we don't intend to back down.
Indeed. Now, of course, a spokesperson for the incoming president-elect said that he supports the idea of the Dakota Pipeline. There's no word yet whether there's an intention to repeal or reverse the Army Corps' order. Do you think it might happen? And what do you folks plan to do if it does?
Well, from our perspective, we want to look at this in a positive light. You know, we are hoping that the government stands by its word. I mean, countless times in the past, the United States has made agreements and deals with the indigenous peoples of this land and completely broken them. We saw similarities in the election process between Trump and Andrew Jackson. Hopefully that doesn't continue on into the administration. We want the administration to be aware that we are counting on them to uphold the government's decision, and we want them to know that the people stand with Standing Rock and that we are not going to go away, that we will confront Trump if he encroaches. But in the meantime, we are counting on him to uphold this decision and to get behind the people, which he claims to be behind. So,
Jacob, where can people find out more about the work that you're doing, the Direct Action Alliance is doing, and any possible and any, you know, future actions?
Well, we have a website. It's directactionalliance.org. We are also on Facebook at Direct Action PDX. Or you can just type in Direct Action Alliance and you will find us. And I just also want to mention that we are working in close coordination, as far as Standing Rock goes, with the Seventh Generation Environmental Alliance, which was founded by Phil Tillery. And they are doing some amazing work here in Portland to rally support for Standing Rock.
Terrific. Again, folks, I've been speaking with Jacob Barreros with the Direct Action Alliance. Yesterday and today, doing actions around the Dakota Pipeline and saying thank you, I guess, to the Army Corps of Engineers for doing the right thing.
Yes, yes.
Jacob, thank you for your time.
I appreciate it.
You take care. Cheers.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline, Energy Transfer Partners, says it has no intention of rerouting despite the Army Corps of Engineers' refusal to grant an easement required to bore beneath the Missouri River near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. What was jubilation at the news Sunday has morphed into cautious optimism at best for the thousands of people opposing the project. Nell Abram with Free Speech Radio News has more.
Sunday afternoon, Candy Mossett of the Indigenous Environmental Network climbed a hill adjacent to the Ocheti Shakowin camp to live stream about a major development.
Moments ago, the White House made an announcement that they are going to deny the permit to bore underneath. The Army Corps of Engineers will deny the permit to bore underneath the Missouri River.
The statement from the Department of the Army's Assistant Secretary for Civil Work, Joanna Darcy, said that alternate routes for the pipeline must be explored, and the best way to do that is to conduct an environmental impact statement. Under existing regulations, there's no federal purview over multi-state pipeline projects. So permitting for the nearly $4 billion project was done on a leg-by-leg basis, with a far less rigorous environmental assessment. An environmental impact statement would require reviewing the project in its totality. Mossett described a joyous celebration at the Camp Sacred Fire, where a human circle formed and people joined hands in song and prayer. But the jubilance was tempered by the fact that an investor in the company building the pipeline is weeks away from becoming the president of the United States.
So, we remain totally happy here, but we remain vigilant and we remain pushing for a full environmental impact statement for the over 1,100-mile-long, four-state-long pipeline.
And that vigilance may not be misplaced. Shortly after the announcement, Energy Transfer Partners, the developers behind the pipeline, released a statement saying the company fully expects to complete pipeline construction without rerouting. It's unclear if that means they plan to forge ahead with construction without the easement, or if they simply view this as a delay until after President Obama steps down. Either way, Standing Rock Sioux Chairman Dave Archambault quickly released a statement of his own, praising the Obama administration for taking steps, quote, to correct the course of history and to do the right thing, close quote. Thousands of people currently in the camp are U.S. military veterans who arrived over the weekend to protect and serve those who plan to ride out the freezing winter to prevent pipeline construction from advancing. As part of a welcoming ceremony held on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation Monday, a group of veterans kneeled before Native American elders and apologized for past crimes committed against the region's original residents, carried out or enabled by then members of the U.S. Armed Forces.
When we took still more land, and then we took your children, and then we tried to take your language, we didn't respect you. We polluted your earth. We hurt you in so many ways. And we've come to say that we are sorry. We are at your service, and we beg for your forgiveness.
But even as the exchange played out, more news broke. Reuters reports that the co-chairs of President-elect Trump's Native American Affairs Coalition are recommending the privatization of energy-rich reservation lands, a complex proposition that could deeply divide Native Americans and open a pathway to deregulated drilling. Today is the deadline to clear the Ocheti-Shakowin camp under an Army Corps eviction notice issued a week ago, which North Dakota Governor Jack Dalrymple followed with an evacuation order. But thousands of people still there show no plans of leaving. Nell Abram, FSRN.
The trial of a former South Carolina police officer accused of killing Walter Scott, an unarmed African American, ended in a mistrial today. Circuit Judge Clifton Newman declared the mistrial after the jury said they were unable to come to a unanimous decision in the state's case against Officer Michael Slager. Scott's death on April 4th of last year was captured on cell phone video by a nearby witness. Slager was shown on film shooting Scott five times from behind after chasing Scott when the 50-year-old father of four fled from a traffic stop. The video showed Scott running away with his back turned to Slager, then an officer with the North Charleston Police Department, when Slager opened fire. The jury of 11 white people and one African American were unable to reach agreement on the murder and manslaughter charges. It appears the result was hung on the opinion of a single jury who said last Friday he sent a note to the judge that said they could not, and I quote here, with good conscience, consider a guilty verdict. Walter Scott's parents were in attendance, and his mother, Judy Scott, said she was confident that Slager would be convicted in a retrial. Walter Scott's brother, Anthony, called for calm in the city after the mistrial announcement and asked people to protest peacefully. Slager was fired from the North Charleston Police Department after the shooting. He was charged with murder in the case, though the jury was also allowed to consider a lesser verdict of manslaughter. If convicted, Slager would have faced 30 years to life in prison. In addition to the upcoming retrial, Slager faces trial next year in federal court on charges that he violated Scott's civil rights.
A fire in an Oakland warehouse on Saturday night has so far claimed 36 lives. As the search for more bodies continues and criminal investigators begin to examine the causes of one of the worst fires in modern California history. As of this morning, about 70% of the building had been searched. An Oakland Fire Department official said they believe the number of fatalities will increase. So far, the names of 7 victims have been released. The Alameda County Sheriff's Deputy said 11 victims have been identified and family members were being notified. Authorities believe the fire began in the back of the building, but they still have no idea what caused it.
On Thursday, the Portland City Council will consider a proposal that would require developers to offer affordable housing units in all new projects with more than 20 residences. The proposal was drafted by the Portland Housing Authority and Portland City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who oversees the department. Developers are claiming the proposed requirement would drive up per-unit costs of housing by forcing the other residences to subsidize the affordable housing units. In an attempt to have new housing developments approved before the proposed law would go into effect, developers have submitted development plans for 14,000 new high-density multifamily residential units. The proposal does provide incentives to developers in order to offset the cost of providing affordable housing. Among the incentives to reduce costs to the developers are elimination of the requirement to provide on-site parking and waiving city development charges. The low-income housing requirement only became possible earlier this year after the Oregon legislature overturned a previous ban on inclusionary housing.
Homeless advocates and the Portland Area Rescue Mission are urging people who are houseless to call 211 to find the nearest available shelter as winter weather descends on Portland. People who would like to donate clothing and other cold weather items can also call the 211 number. A winter weather advisory has been issued for the Portland area with below freezing temperatures and snow showers expected today and this evening. The temperatures tonight and tomorrow morning are expected to dip into the low 20s. Once again, to find the nearest shelter or to donate cold weather clothing, people can call 211 on any telephone.
You're listening to the song Eudaimonia by Them or Us Too, the band of artists Cash Askew, 22, one of the many victims of Friday night's massive warehouse fire in Oakland. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned at 6 for Labor Radio of the Working Class, by the Working Class, and for the Working Class. That's followed at 6:30 by Prison Pipeline, presenting a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, address the root causes of crime, and challenge the status quo. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather. There's a winter weather advisory in effect for the Portland area above 700 feet elevation until 1 a.m. Rain showers likely before 10, then a chance of rain and snow showers. Cloudy with a low around 34. Chance of precipitation is 60%. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Tomorrow, 30% chance of snow showers before 10 a.m., mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 41. Little or no snow accumulation expected. Today in history, in 1933, alcohol prohibition came to an end as the state of Utah ratified the 21st Amendment to the Constitution, repealing the 18th Amendment. And in 1955, the American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations merged to form the AFL-CIO. The quote of the day is from the late humorist Will Rogers, who once said, "Funny to watch these senators switching back and forth on prohibition. Politics is a great character builder. You have to take a referendum to see what your convictions are for that day."
Now for something a little different. From H2O Radio, it's This Week in Water.
Cruise line caught cheating. That and other stories on H2O Radio's weekly news report about water. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
As California enters into what may be its sixth year of drought, the state released a draft plan to make permanent what were temporary water efficiency or conservation standards.
Officials note that the state has suffered the driest 4 years in history, and 75% of California is still in severe drought conditions.
The new plan proposes to ban some practices permanently, such as hosing off sidewalks and driveways and excessive lawn watering.
But it also takes into consideration local circumstances, such as temperature and drier climate zones. For example, Palm Springs in the desert would have a different water budget than San Francisco.
The conservation plans have received criticism from environmentalists who say they do not require any new cutbacks from agricultural districts.
Ben Chu of the Natural Resources Defense Council says that agriculture should be required to identify opportunities for saving water and recognize the benefits of more efficient practices.
While the state was trying to deal with the drought, residents of Hillsboro, one of the richest communities in California, are suing their town over its tiered water rate structure.
One resident who's suing is Dave Marquardt, an early investor in Microsoft. His three-story house sits on an acre and a half of landscaped grounds.
Those bringing the lawsuit claim that it violates a state proposition which requires Hillsboro to charge only what it costs to supply the water, but the tiered structure promotes conservation.
As of June this year, the town uses about 320 gallons per resident per day, which is about three times the state average.
The mayor of Gatlinburg, Tennessee, said that the wildfire which devastated his community last week was unlike anything they had ever seen.
Recent reports put the death toll from the blaze at 13, and 85 people were injured. About 1,000 buildings were damaged in the town.
Drought conditions have affected the area all summer and into the fall. Around the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, the rainfall deficit is nearly 20 inches, and Tennessee is having its third warmest year on record.
It's not yet clear whether climate change will make these types of fires in the southeast more common, but according to Chip Conrad at the University of North Carolina, this fall has seen many more wildfires than what's normal.
Dr. John Abraham, a professor of thermal sciences, writes in The Guardian that climate change did cause this fire, and it's known that human-caused warming is making drought and heat more severe.
Clashes broke out between police and protesters in Nicaragua over the construction of a gigantic canal from the Caribbean to the Pacific.
11 people were injured on Wednesday in an area about 180 miles from the capital of Managua. The protesters had planned to go to the capital later last week, but called it off, saying they are peace lovers and wanted to avoid confrontations.
A Chinese investment firm is backing the new canal, and the government of Daniel Ortega says it will lift the country out of poverty.
If undertaken, the project could be the biggest earth-moving operation in history. It will dig a 30-yard-wide channel nearly 200 miles long, so that even the world's largest ships could pass through the isthmus between the Pacific and the the Atlantic.
But the project would have devastating consequences, according to opponents. Hundreds of thousands would be forced from their land.
And indigenous peoples, local residents, and environmentalists say it will cause damage to Lake Nicaragua, which is the largest lake in Central America.
Princess Cruise Lines has agreed with the U.S. government to pay a $40 million penalty and admit to 7 felonies for polluting the ocean with waste and trying to cover it up.
The Washington Post reports that the charges mainly concern one ship, the 3,200-passenger Caribbean Princess. A whistleblower revealed that the ship used a magic pipe to bypass the usual system.
Thousands of gallons of oily waste were illegally dumped, according to the government. An investigation determined that the ship had been making illegal discharges since 2005.
According to the online news outlet Quartz, as of 2014, about 1 billion gallons of sewage are dumped into oceans each year by cruise ships.
Princess Cruise Lines said that it regretted the actions and blamed problems on rogue employees. The company will undergo monitoring for 5 years to assure compliance with environmental standards. And finally, speaking of cruise ships, given the chance, would you have wanted to sail aboard the Titanic?
Well, if so, you're in luck. In about 2 years, you might be able to walk the decks of the ill-fated ocean liner.
But not the one that sits at the bottom of the Atlantic. This one's a replica being built by a Chinese company.
And with this ship, you're safe from hitting any icebergs. The tourist attraction is being built in a landlocked reservoir in China's southwestern Sichuan province and will never actually set sail.
Even so, for a mere $435 in steerage class, your one-night stay will include a simulated iceberg crash with the sound of water rushing in using special effects.
The hope, according to the developers, is that you will think, and this is a quote, "The water will drown me. I must escape for my life."
Doesn't that sound fun?
If all this sounds a bit in bad taste, as the original Titanic left more than 1,500 people killed in appalling circumstances, don't worry. The producer assures critics that the experience will be exhilarating, but done in a respectful way.
And although this seems a bit ghoulish for us, for the Chinese, the replica appears to be less about the horrible disaster and more about the romance depicted in the James Cameron blockbuster film.
The Chinese are smitten by the steamy tale of a poor young man and a beautiful high society woman.
How enamored? According to the New York Post, most people of a certain age in China can sing the theme song from the movie. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn about water efficiency and resilience at awwa.org/sustainable.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you.
The City of Portland's Parks and Recreation Bureau works with immigrant and refugee communities in a big way. That's why it's no surprise that the City of Portland's Immigrant of the Year, named last week, is Sam Sabaty, the Park Bureau's Engagement Coordinator. One of Sam's biggest programs is the Parks for New Portlanders program. Sam, thanks very much for coming into KBOO tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First, Sam, a little background on you for our listeners. What country are you originally from, and how did you get to Portland?
So I'm a former refugee, and I am a first-generation Nepali-speaking Bhutanese New American. Though American English is my fifth language.
Oh my, that's amazing.
Yeah, American English is my fifth language.
But five languages, yeah.
Yeah, so one is fourth language, second is Nepali, where that's my mother tongue. Third is Hindi, fourth is British English, and fifth is American English.
Oh, you kind of separate the two, British,
yes,
and American English.
Yes, it's
English.
A lot of differences.
I think the British would be all for that. But
So I was born in Bhutan, a country between China and India. And I was forcefully evicted early 90s, and I was forced to live in a refugee camp in Nepal for almost 20 years.
20 years?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Between four walls of bamboo walls and a thatched roof and a bed mud.
And that was waiting to come to the U.S. or some other country?
So we waited to go back to Bhutan all these years, but there were efforts made. There were bilateral talks between Nepal and Bhutan. All those efforts were failed. So in 2008, with $10 in my pants pocket and a plastic bag and with my bachelor's degree documents, I came to Portland. And I've been here since 8.5 years, and Portland is my new home.
And now you work for the city of Portland, which is great, and the Portland Parks and Recreation Bureau. We mentioned some of the projects you do, but what's your job there?
So my job is to work with the refugees and immigrants who are new to Portland, and I create culturally responsive recreational activities for new Portlander families and connect new Portlander families to city park programs and other city resources. And also what I do is I partner with bureaus and try to lower the gap.
And we mentioned also in the introduction, and this was an award that I just heard about, City of Portland has an Immigrant of the Year Award, and you won it. It was announced just about a week ago. Can you tell us a little bit more about this honor?
So I got a call two nights before the ceremony. So,
as a surprise,
as a surprise. But I mean, that's the validation of what I do, why I do, right? And it's a great honor at this kind of crazy situation now. That I think the work has to be validated, and there are a lot of immigrant refugees who are in fear. So I dedicated that award to all these folks who are in fear and who, to all those advocates who are working for refugees and immigrants in this country.
Yeah, I actually had that question a little later, but why don't we get to it now? It's kind of the elephant in the room. After the election, we have a president-elect who ran an extremely exclusionary and hateful campaign. So what are your suggestions to immigrants and people who might feel endangered now and might feel that way over the next 4 years?
So there is a lot of concern about what will happen at a federal level. Many of the proposed ideas are step backwards, not forward. And we heard that in the campaign. After decades of war, which is growing around the planet, many more people and countries are being displaced. The U.S. plays an important role and opportunity for people around the world. And U.S. is champion on this humanitarian issue.
And also as a place of refuge to accept people who are leaving their countries for all sorts of reasons.
Yes. And if we shut down our borders, many people will feel that the U.S. is turning its back. And that supports the crazy terrorism going on outside the country. So I think we need to keep opening our door. And if I was not provided that an opportunity, I wouldn't be in Portland, I wouldn't be paying taxes, I wouldn't be able to buy a house and start giving back to the community. So I am one of the examples how welcoming a refugee can make a change in the community.
So hopefully the people of Portland can kind of band together here and make sure that those doors remain open over the next 4 years and beyond.
Yes, and we have seen that local commitment from our city officials, from our mayor-elect and the current mayor, Charlie Hales, and governor of Oregon. She said last year that she will keep welcoming refugees in eastern Oregon. So locally, we're really good, but we have a lot to do, to work on, but so far we are kind of safe and kind of happy and kind of determined from this leaders.
Somewhat better off maybe than the rest of the country, at least for accepting immigrants and refugees.
Yes. And if you see, it's on West Coast, I mean, California and Washington governors, they have said that way too.
And several cities have declared themselves sanctuary cities too.
Yes.
Portland's one of them.
Yeah, New York City and LA, yeah, those cities, yes.
Let's get to Portland. It's often called, and I've disagreed with this before, and apparently there's data that backs me up on this. It's often called the whitest major city in America. In researching this, I found out that 1 in 5 Portlanders are foreign born. So in a way, it's not that homogenous. Can you talk about our growing newcomer communities, and how would you define the words immigrant and refugee?
So we all are immigrants, right, except Native Americans. So immigrants, sometimes they choose to come to America. Refugees, they don't have choice. They had to flee their homes, school, jobs at once without knowing them. So they're evicted, and refugees come from the second, like, host country where they fled to America. And also, so due to I don't have that much experience about Portland's community, but as you said, like, what a city. But and also, 1 in 5 Portlanders are foreign born, and half of the Portland Public School District School students of color, they go to non-speakers.
And that's growing, I would imagine. The population is becoming, there's more people coming from out of the country into Portland as hopefully a safe harbor.
And also, I think we will see in our next 2020 census that it will show our demographics.
And some of this that we've been talking about now will be reflected in those numbers,
yes,
in the census.
Yes, and also Portland has, I think, 70 plus ethnic communities here.
So I was going to ask you about that.
We don't count those when we talk about, like, as where the city here.
Yeah.
So that's kind of dangerous.
One statistic I had heard a few months ago was that actually the third language in the state after English and Spanish is Russian. So there's surprisingly enough, there's a large Russian community. Since you work with immigrant youth and families, can you tell us where they're arriving from? Multiple places, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's all over the world. And we are richer every day, and we are diverse every day. And this diversity is not a threat to any group. So that's, I just want to make that clear. And the countries specific are from Asia, Africa, Eastern Europe, Mexico, Central and Southern America.
So all over. There's
folks from,
And what kind of services do you provide the youth and the families in your park and recreation programs?
So we started with the Portland World Cup Soccer Tournament.
I've heard of that, yes.
Yeah, we had around 30 youth and families from 30 different countries last year, countries, culture, and communities. So this year, I started tracking in just two teams, and I found there are 23 languages spoken. Just two teams in Southeast Portland, and I got tired and I stopped counting.
Did you have some kind of relationship between the tournament and these teams and our Major League Soccer team, the Timbers?
That's a work in progress, mm-hmm. right? Coming from that background, like just 8 years in the country, and also kind of like just working on building on the program now. And Parks Bureau, we have good connection, and we are still we are working on partnering with them for summer camps and other programs.
Now, what are some of the biggest issues you see for the immigrants and the refugees coming into Portland?
It's a common housing issue, right? So a lot of families are moving out of the city, and also there are a lot of folks who are homeless, and they're not reported. They live in communities, couch and sofas and the living room. And also the language, there's a language barrier still exists. And sometimes the biggest issue is us. So sometimes we don't prioritize the issue. So that is kind of affecting also.
By us, you mean the city of Portland or the residents of Portland?
I mean, the stakeholders are who is, we is assigned to serve. So mm-hmm. that's a big barrier. So that kind of like creates more gap. And also lack of information. These families, sometimes they don't know what we provide, right? So that creates another challenge for these families.
Oh, how do you get the word out about that? Is there some kind of greeting committee when immigrants and refugees come into the city and you let them know what services are available for them?
So we have great refugee resettlement agencies like Lutheran, Catholic, and SOAR. They bring refugees from airport and provide housing, connect to the welfare system, connect to the school system, healthcare system. But once they get into Portland, when I am about to do an event, I go to their churches, I go to their mosque, I go to their temples, I go to their ethnic stores, I talk to community leaders. They know where I live. So that's why I don't make some good big promises, because they can knock door on Saturdays.
You told us.
Yeah, so
the streets would be paved with gold here. I'm not saying that.
Yeah, so Yeah, those are kind of like some of the steps we don't realize in kind of mainstream world, right? So those are the, because I know where they live and those community leaders know where their community members live. So that's how the words are getting out to those communities.
And you talked about the soccer program, which I imagine is very popular with the younger immigrants and refugees. What are some of the issues that this group is interested in, the youth among the people you work with?
So you mean the youth were interested?
Oh, yeah, the younger, when immigrants and refugees come in, the younger members of the family. They actually would represent the kind of the second generation.
So the interests are the same, like the youth who are born here, right? So there's not that much difference. But the youth coming from other part of the world, they have language barrier. They're new to the system, new to the culture, and they don't get that much support. Some community members or even the family members, they don't speak that much English, and they have the hard time getting homework help done or other projects done. And also, they are not kind of privileged comparing our mainstream kids who are born here or who have different skin color comparing refugees and immigrants. So, yeah, that's what they are facing now.
Can we get a little specific? Do you have some success stories to tell the listeners about immigrants and refugees who came in and how these programs helped them and hopefully how they're prospering now or doing well in Portland?
So when I was working as a refugee case manager at Lutheran Community Services before this job, I resettled a young man called Eder Mutara. Later on, he started helping me in the World Cup soccer.
Where's Eder from?
He's from Congo, and he speaks 11 languages.
My God, the intelligence of the people coming into this, much more than the people who are already here.
That's why the problem
myself included.
With us, sometimes we don't hear their stories. We don't go to talk to them. Sometimes we are kind of like, we have that kind of brainwashed mind from the media that our refugees are bad, they're terrorists. But we need to go to them and talk to them, come to the events, volunteer, mentor them. So those are the good steps we can take.
And how can we do that for people who wish they could reach out cross-culturally in the city? Do you have any ideas on how we could learn more about immigrant and refugee issues or perhaps meet people within these communities in a constructive, positive way?
So first thing, I think we have to be open-minded and just give a chance. If I were not given a chance, I wouldn't be a successful one and working with the city and giving back to the community now. So just think about giving a chance, that how we were given a chance in the past. So just give them a chance and look at them. So they don't come for free. Refugees, they have to pay a travel loan. They don't come for free. And for me, I got around $1,000 as a support initially in Portland.
So you had $1,010 at that time, right? You had mentioned coming across with a $10.
Yeah, just in Portland. Yeah. I'm total, like welfare and rent and other things.
Right.
But so far, I have paid around $80,000 in tax. Back to the system. So it's benefits to the system. So we have to see that kind of positive story than just going negatively and blaming refugees.
And as you mentioned, we're really all immigrants and refugees other than the Native Americans, and somebody gave somebody in our family a chance at one point. And
yes,
that's all we're asking.
That will change everything. And believe me, and I have done that, and I proved to American and Portlanders already.
Oh, well, Sam, thanks very much for coming into Portland, to KBOO today. And that was Sam Sabaty, the Park Bureau's engagement coordinator. And Sam was named last week as the City of Portland's Immigrant of the Year. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
You can find out more about Sam's works at the Parks for New Portlanders program. You can contact him, actually, at sam.sabaty, and that's S-O-M, period, S-U-B-E-D-I, at portlandoregonalloneword.gov. Or you can call them directly at 503-260-2487.
And now we hear the latest in workers-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Indiana AFL-CIO says it's cautiously optimistic about the deal struck by Trump and carrier executives to save jobs, while elated that 1,100 working people and their families know their jobs are safe this holiday season. The Indiana AFL-CIO says 1,370 people between the two plants in Huntington and Indianapolis are still
losing their jobs to Mexico. And since Carrier's announcement in February that it was sending jobs to Mexico, several other Indiana plants have announced they too are shipping more American jobs to Mexico. So Indiana Organized Labor says until every working family in America feels secure knowing their job will remain in the U.S., we will expect the president-elect to uphold his campaign promise. National Nurses United in Washington, D.C. says there can be no moratorium on fixing dangerously understaffed hospitals in the nation's capital. District of Columbia's council chairman Phil Mendelson says that he will impose a 2-year moratorium on bills before the council that regulate the district's businesses. That includes legislation that would establish safe nurse-patient staffing ratios in Washington, D.C. hospitals. Union nurses say they will not accept a moratorium by elected leaders on ensuring safe care for our patients. The nurses say there will be no moratorium on nurse demands for safe patient care in hospitals. Neo-Nazi white supremacist groups are emboldened by the results of the presidential election, and that's prompting media that cover these 21st century Nazis to reevaluate how the racist groups are covered. The Associated Press just released standards for reporting on the so-called alt-right movement. That's a name that's designed to normalize the presence of neo-Nazis in America who supported Donald Trump. The Associated Press urges reporters to avoid using the alt-right name unless they provide ample context about who and what these 21st century Nazis really are. Otherwise, AP says, the media risks normalizing their extreme views to a mass audience.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 725,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Brought to you by UnionJobs.com, posting jobs for unions, socially allied, and community organizations since 1997.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at TheUnionEdge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
A popular pizza restaurant in Northwest Washington, D.C., was the subject